Joining us now in the studio, we have a special guest, Assemblymember Henry T. Perea from Fresno, someone who's very familiar with these issues of water in the state of California. Assemblymember Perea, welcome.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Just yesterday, officials with the state's Department of Water Resources held an event calling attention to the worry about another dry year and what that might mean for the entire state, especially the Central Valley. This is a big concern for folks in your district. The Bay Delta Conservation Plan has been going on for years now, and we're finally starting to see it coalesce, but there's still a lot of concern about what it actually means. Where do you see the current state of the plan, and how does it work for the Valley?
Well, I think the BDCP is still very controversial and very divisive, mostly between the North Valley and the South Valley, where we live here in Fresno. But I do think that it's important to note that the preservation and the enhancement of the Delta is important for all of our economies and for all of our communities to thrive. It's not just important for the communities that are in the Delta, but it's important for those of us who rely on Delta water here in Fresno in the South Valley, but as well as Southern California, who also rely heavily on the Delta, and ensuring that the Delta is healthy and sustainable is important for all of us. So I think that while it's still controversial and the governor, is as part of BDCP, is proposing his twin tunnels, which is hugely controversial up and down the entire state, I do think it really points to the broader picture. And that is that we have to make smart infrastructure investments to make sure that we have that we allow to move the water that we currently have in a way that's most efficient.
What are you hearing from farmers in this part of the state right now and their concerns about the future going forward just with what we have right now? We're all hoping for a wet year, but we don't know yet.
Well, I mean, I think nobody's optimistic. And everybody is extremely concerned. I mean, just listening to your report and talking with Farmer Joe Del Bosque, who I think really did a very good job in describing what's really happening out on the, especially out on the west side of Fresno County, because of the lack of water. But even if we did have a good year, we still have capacity issues where we don't have the amount of storage that we need to capture the water that we could use in dry years, like what we think is going to be this year. So we still have infrastructure issues that we have to address, whether it's above and below ground storage, conveyance, that could be the tunnels, that could be just restoring the Delta so that more water can flow through the Delta. I mean, there are a number of ways at looking at trying to produce and enhance the amount of water that we have in our valley, but all options have to be on the table, and I think they are. We're just trying to put together the right political coalition to get it done.
And that's a big concern. There's a talk of this $25 billion tunnel plan. There's a lot of concern about the cost there. There's a lot of concern about also the environmental costs. There are folks who are concerned about the health of the Delta, and they say taking any more water out of the Delta is going to be detrimental to that ecosystem. They say there's no way that you can conserve the Delta by taking more water out. When it comes to cost, though, regardless of the environmental issue, this is going to be a very expensive project. And there's some people raising questions about whether water users, whether they're in Southern California or Valley farmers, are going to want to pay the cost of this type of system. What's the breaking point there? Where do you see that going?
Well, I think it is important to note, as you just mentioned, that the cost of this project is going to be borne by the user. So the taxpayers are not going to be on the hook for this. It's going to be those that will benefit from the flow of the water will be on the hook for paying for the project. Where that breaking point is, I think it's different for every agency. Every agency that will see a benefit from the project will have to make a determination what is their breaking point? What is their price point that they're willing to pay for the water? Right now, we just don't know that yet. I think everybody's trying to get to a place because they need – get to a place where they can say yes because they need the water and the reliability so desperately. But these water districts that will be paying the bill, of course, are going to have to go back to their members, which are farmers, in the case of Metropolitan Water District in Los Angeles, its consumers, and will they be able to sustain an increase in their rates in order to pay for the reliability? I don't have the answer to that. I do think that most are trying to figure out a way to say yes.
Again, if you just joined us on Valley Edition today, we're talking with Assemblymember Henry T. Perea of Fresno about California's water situation. The issue is often framed as farmers versus environmentalists. That's what we often hear in the Valley. You drive up and down Highway 99 or Interstate 5 or 41, and you see these trailers, and they attack certain members for not being for the farmers. But it's really a lot more complex than that, because you have farmers in the northern part of the Valley, north of the Delta, in the Delta, that are on opposite sides of the issue from the farmers in Fresno County, Kings County, Kern County. There's a lot of different interests. How do you go about trying to build a coalition in trying to get whatever, whether it's a $5 billion plan or a $25 billion mm-hmm. plan through? How do you go about building that coalition when even interests that, to the layperson, you would think, well, all farmers are going to be for more water.
Right.
It's a lot more complex than that. How do you build that coalition?
It's much more complex than that. And I think we have to start in any time you're looking to build a coalition, everybody has to get something out of it. And we can't let, as we move through the process of building a coalition, we can't let the perfect be the enemy of the good, meaning that every member, every stakeholder of the coalition is going to have to know coming into a negotiation that they're not going to get everything that they want, but that they have to see the big picture and why it's important to make sure that water is flowing efficiently and effectively across our state for all of our economies. Because it's not just, as you mentioned, environmentalists opposed to agricultural interests, but it's farmers in the North Delta who are fighting farmers in Fresno. It's the fishermen that are fighting both the environmentalists and the farmers. You have big metropolitan communities like Los Angeles who need to see a fix in the Delta that are now entering the fray in a much larger way than we've ever seen before. We have interests in the northern part of the state who don't want anything to be done, because in their mind, it can only be bad, because most of the water is in Northern California, and they see this as the southern part of the state stealing their water. So this is less about the Valley and more about the Northern California versus Los Angeles constituency. So the issue becomes, can we bring the right mix of stakeholders together who won't let the perfect be the enemy of the good and will allow for some sort of compromise and negotiation to occur? And we're going to get our first crack at that when we start renegotiating the water bond this year.
And that's what I want to go to next. Voters may soon have a chance to weigh in on this. A few years ago, when Governor Schwarzenegger originally proposed the water bond, it was an $11.1 billion measure that has changed in many forms over the years. Right before the legislature adjourned for the year, it was raised. It was cut. It was raised. It's now set $6.5 billion. There's a lot of horse trading going on and things in this process. Can you bring us up to date on where it stands right now and where do you stand on the water bond?
Sure. So I'm very supportive of the water bond. And if the legislature does nothing in renegotiating the water bond, there will be a bond for the voters to vote on this coming election in November. Now, all the public polls point to the fact that this bond doesn't pass. And so that's why we're trying to renegotiate what that looks like. So we're trying to get under $10 billion. The current bond is just a little over 11. We're trying to get under 10 and try to cut some of the maybe less, some of the projects that are not as closely related to water and really just stay focused to really the core mission of what a water bond should be. And in my mind, it should really address three things. It should address the sustainability in the Delta. It should provide infrastructure projects so we can store and move water along. And we need to invest more in clean drinking water projects, not just for the Valley, but up and down the entire state to deal with issues like high levels of nitrates and arsenic and other issues, other contaminants that are poisoning our waters up and down the state. So I see those as the three key pieces of the bond. Now, can we do all that with $6, $8, $9 billion? It's going to be very difficult. But the beginning of the year, I do currently sit on the Speaker's Working Group for reworking the water bond. And so we, you know, as members of the legislature, are meeting with stakeholders, and we're trying to find those sweet spots with the various stakeholders to try to find a bond that will be less, that will hopefully earn voter support next November.
You mentioned cleaning up drinking water for residents in rural communities in the Valley. That's been a big issue for years here. And in the last year, you've drafted some legislation that was recently signed by the governor on that issue. There have been some bottlenecks in Sacramento for years that have prevented some of these communities from cleaning up the nitrate pollution, cleaning up some wells that are really bad, and people who otherwise don't have clean drinking water. Have we cleared those bottlenecks now with some of this recent legislation? Where do we stand with that?
Sure. So the answer is yes and no. Yes, in that we had some bills signed by the governor this year that have cleaned up some of the bureaucratic roadblocks that have prevented many of our disadvantaged communities from accessing money to clean their drinking water. But the big issue, really, and one of the bills that I was unable to get through this year was a bill that would have moved the responsibility of the Clean Drinking Water Program from the Department of Public Health to the State Water Board. And the whole point of doing that is because the State Water Board has a very good track record in moving money from the state to disadvantaged communities to get the projects needed so they can have clean drinking water. DPH, on the other hand, does not have the same record. In fact, the US EPA sent them a letter telling them that their $455 million was in jeopardy because of their inability to administer the funds to get out to these small communities. And so we attempted to make that move this year. We were unsuccessful, although I will say that recent word is that the governor's office is still going to look at making that move and that it may in fact happen during next year's budget.
Very interesting. Moving on to some other issues, we heard the report on prisons just a few moments ago and the news that the U.S. Supreme Court today rejected Governor Brown's request for an appeal on the effort to move the deadline for reducing the number of prisoners in the state's overcrowded prisons. Where do you stand on the issue of trying to sort this out? The governor has his plan for trying to house some of these inmates. He doesn't want to release any more inmates than have already been released and is looking at private prisons and other things to try to solve this issue. Some people say our prison population is much too large and our prisons simply aren't working. They aren't reducing recidivism at all. We need to look at other sorts of strategies beyond this locking people up. Where do you stand on trying to sort this out? Because it's pretty clear the courts are not backing down from their belief that the conditions right now are intolerable and unconstitutional.
So I voted to support the governor's plan, and I think the governor's plan is a short-term solution to ensure that thousands of prisoners are not released out into our streets. And so I support the plan, and I believe it was the right thing to do. Now, it does buy us some time to really think about the big picture and where do we go from here. Like, I'm a big believer in balance. I believe in finding the right balance in keeping people locked up for committing the crimes that they do, especially those that create heinous crimes. But we have to provide a pathway for people to be rehabilitated. And that means making real investments. And so I think we're going to have to make two investments. The investments to keep people locked up, and if that means building more prisons or if that means enhancing the current conditions that we have to keep people in, I support that. But I also believe that for those individuals that want to do something with their lives, that want the opportunity to make amends, we should provide every opportunity in order for them to do that. And that means investing in education, investing in vocational education, investing in the right programs, drug counseling within our prison system so that people have the resources they need to get their lives back on track. I'm a firm believer in redemption, and I believe that taking both tracks is where we need to go. But the gut check for the legislature and the governor is going to be, do we want to pay for it? And we'll find out. When the budget comes next year.
We have a couple minutes left. I want to ask you about a couple of bills that you authored that the governor recently signed. This workers' compensation bill with professional athletes is kind of interesting. And this issue, I think, is something that's kind of under the radar for most people. You had athletes from out of state that were filing claims in California. Your bill, it has addressed that. The governor signed it. Where does that stand, and how is that going to affect California moving forward?
Well, it turned out to be one of the hottest issues of the year with professional athletes storming the Capitol in opposition. So in a nutshell, what we were finding is was that, let's say, a baseball player would pitch one inning in California but play his entire career somewhere else. They would file for workers' comp in California. The same was happening in the NFL, the NBA. Athletes with very little ties to the state were filing for workers' comp here, in addition to filing for workers' comp in their home state. Now, why should Californians care about that? Well, many of the insurance carriers that were supposed to pay for these claims were going bankrupt. And when they go bankrupt, that means the California Insurance Guarantee Association, the California business owners, end up picking up the tab for all of that. And so it was a huge issue, and it turned out to be a huge cost for California businesses. And so now that the governor signed it into law, we didn't say that they couldn't file for workers' comp in California, but we set some very clear parameters as to who qualifies and who doesn't, which didn't exist in the past. So I feel like the compromise that we reached moving forward is a very good compromise, and it allows for a framework and for some benchmarks to be met before professional athletes could file for workers' comp in California, preserving our system, but also maintaining access when it's required.
And one last question. Assembly Bill 219, which is now law, the governor signed it. It's about cancer treatment and medication. Very briefly, tell us what that's about and why you supported it.
Very near and dear to my heart. I lost my mother to cancer a year and a half ago. Essentially, what we did with AB 219 is said that we are putting a $200 cap on the cost of oral chemotherapy. We had Brent Flowers, a cancer patient who testified from Fresno for us. She was spending $3,000 to $4,000 a month on her oral chemotherapy. AB 219 will ensure that she and other patients will spend no more than $200 a month on their medication.
So the insurance companies make up the difference. How does that work?
The cost is spread among everybody in their premiums. Okay. And the analysis shows that it's less than a penny per person.
Again, Assemblymember Henry T. Perea joining us today on Valley Edition, talking water, prisons, and all sorts of things with the end of the legislative session. Assemblymember Perea, thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you.